Without coincidence, there would be no story. Shi Nian. Welcome to this week's episode of Warfare, Advancement, and Revisionism. My name is Preston Floyd, and as always, I'm your host. I'd like to thank everyone for joining me this week. I appreciate the support. If you're a newcomer, welcome. I hope you will enjoy and peruse our backlog of episodes. And if you're a returning listener, thank you, as always, for your continued support. This week, we will be continuing looking at humans living at Neolithic sites along the Yellow River and its systems between 6 and 4,000 BC. Before that, though, I did have some stuff I wanted to go over and mention. The first YouTube episodes with slides, I guess, for lack of a better term, pictures to be featured seems to have been very well received. I want to thank the YouTube subscribers who have asked for those and kind of encouraged me to kind of get that out there. And if you are someone who's only listening to the audio podcast, you're not missing too much. But, you know, if you'd like to check us out there, please do. Also, please rate, subscribe, download, thumbs up, whatever your service of choice kind of uses to help push episodes out or just kind of show support. Please follow up on those if you have the time. Before that, before we move on, though, again, some other stuff I wanted to follow up on. I did find out more about the theory that some of these societies were initially matriarchal. I did some reading, and thank you to a couple of people who kind of pointed this out, but I had already kind of found a little bit what I was looking for. But apparently, that was just kind of the default assumption, or at least the default announcement at all Neolithic sites in China. You see, the theory that there was a kind of universal earth slash mother goddess slash cult kind of thing that was eventually overthrown by patriarchies is a, you know, it's an old and fairly popular theory. And I've mentioned it in earlier episodes, though I may need to do like a deeper dive on it. I'll think about that one. But one group that has always been kind of extremely supportive and enthusiastic about this theory were Marxist historians. They were not the only ones. But for most of them, not all of them, but most of them, it in some cases became dogmatic. You see, it kind of fits right in with their theory of production and social development. So you start with a simple communist societies where everyone's working together. Never mind that they're all related to each other. But it simply goes from these simple communist societies, then these societies develop to what are considered, according to Marxist, classical Marxist historical theory, they advance to then slave societies, to then feudal societies, to then capitalist, then to socialist, and then finally to communist. And of course, the Chinese are very good communists, and far be it for them to go against the very clear theory of natural progression of societies and production. Never mind that in that theory, a communist state is the final stage of development of a society, and the PRC is a communist state, and so it is the only legitimate form and government for all the peoples of China. Now, since the 1990s, that strict or enforced adherence to dogma isn't nearly as prevalent, but there is kind of still a social stigma seen with correcting or disagreeing with your elders and seniors in certain fields. You can do it, but it has to be done very carefully, very thoughtfully. So a lot of more recent studies and works don't even make mention of the subject outright. They'll just break down actual, noticeable, discernible facts, and then maybe those will support a certain theory. Maybe they won't. But it at least is open enough to determination to not rule various theories out. So that's generally how they're approaching things. Now, maybe those early Chinese historians felt pressure politically, some of them definitely did, to kind of couch the developments in this way, but, you know, maybe they believed it, maybe they didn't. But by and large, today, some of those theories, they just don't bring them back up if they haven't found evidence. They just kind of let them lie. But with that out of the way, I did just want to, again, kind of put a few things out there about that. First, there are Marxist historians who do not agree with Marxist politics or Marxist economic theory, but they do favor large parts of their historical narrative of human development, or at least how they approach their study of history through materialism and artifacts. Though technically speaking, there were other people doing that well before Marx. It's just that Marx and Engels did, you know, kind of create a working theory to tie their view of history in with their view of economics and politics, which was unique. And so the entire concept just got named after Marx by other Marxists, but there you go. Though there are some historians who just use the term materialist because they don't want anything to do with the political aspect of their work, which, to be fair, I don't blame them. Secondly, there has never been any definitive archaeological evidence discovered that shows widespread matriarchal or matristic societies in China or anywhere else. Now, that is not to say that there wasn't one or many matriarchal societies. It's just that something like that isn't going to show up in the archaeological record. It can really only be proven, you know, in very specific circumstances. And in some cases, that's true for patriarchy, too. There may be some societies that are assumed to be patriarchal, but there's no way to really prove that. And when I talk about matriarchy, I mean women wielding supreme political or decision-making power and then receiving/distributing the profits or losses of said decisions among their communities and members of those communities. And mostly or completely excluding men from that process. Now, there have been social organizations that do prioritize men or women over men in some or most aspects of life, but few of these are strictly matriarchal by that definition. You have peoples who do trace their lineages matrilineally. And in more and more academic spaces, you'll also start to see terms used like matrifocal, which is where women head families, where like the mother's in charge, or the grandmother, or the great-grandmother, or what have you. Then you also have matrilocal, which means married couples reside with or near the wife's parents. Or you know, it's a combination of matrifocal, matrilocal, and matrilineality or matriarchy. The closest society that I can think of to be a matriarchy would probably be the Iroquois, though I know other Native American groups did have more politically powerful women too, like the Hopi, I think is one of the big examples that comes to me off the top of my head, though I don't know the exact level of control or input that the Hopi women had to the Iroquois women. The Iroquois women, for those that don't know, they had kind of like a council of female elders, and they exercised a lot of political control. They could remove chiefs if they all got together and voted on it. Though a woman from the chief who was removed would be able to appoint his replacement. So they're more punishing strictly the men, the individual men, and not the family as a whole when you see that happen. Now, that does lead into a question I had from a couple of listeners about a different but related subject. Were there or are there any matriarchal societies anywhere in China? And that answer is, again, matriarchal. You got a little bit of leeway. You could do matrilocal, matrifocal. But yes, there are. And these people are known as the Mosuo. They live further south than the regions we talked about last week and this week. They're spread across, I think, the Yunnan and Sichuan provinces, kind of in China's very far southwest. And there's about 50,000 of them. They're matrifocal and trace their lineages from their mother's side. Women do most of the work in Mosuo society. They run the households, fields. They produce like a lot of domestic goods in their homes. They are in charge of feeding animals, and they make decisions about how family land and animals will be used. Now, this has led some people to think that the men don't do anything except hang around and wait for a woman to invite them over for a good time, I guess is the way to put it. That isn't true. Men do work. They do work at the direction of their matrons, mostly with livestock tasks not related to feeding, and they're the only ones allowed to slaughter animals. That's either domesticated animals or through things like hunting and fishing. They also do construction work on their homes, and they share like a common a home together. It's kind of like a square or a large rectangular structure. They kind of have like a central courtyard in the center of a few outer buildings. They all live in kind of common areas, men and women, though women of a certain age are allowed private rooms for reasons we'll get into later. But everyone else kind of lives in a common area. They have like a general living vicinity. There's a general like group sleeping area. But then again, women, you know, that are old enough to have children and not too old to have children are allowed private kind of domiciles within that that home complex. Also, I should point out that the men are not politically controlled. They have a equal say in matters outside of the domestic sphere, and in some cases, I think they have more of a say, at least in certain aspects. They would, in the past, have had the final say on if they needed to go to war or something like that. They would, you know, kind of organize themselves and, you know, see who needed to do what in that regard. Men also teach their younger family members certain skills when they reach, you know, kind of that coming of age period of their life. They'll teach them what they need to know to fulfill their roles. They also help provide discipline to younger children. Just like the adult women in the family do. They kind of share that role. The only difference is that the children they're caring for are not theirs. They're their nieces and nephews, or in larger families, you know, cousins are thrown in with that. Possibly, in some cases, maybe even younger siblings. Because while the Moswo are matrilineal, they are not matrifocal. Men do not move in with their partners. The Moswo do not really have a formal marriage among themselves. They practice what is known as a walking marriage. If a man and woman are kind of in a relationship, the man will visit the woman when she invites him. He goes to her home after dark. He stays with her and then leaves kind of first thing in the morning. And any children they have are considered a part of the woman's family. The man has no obligations to provide any kind of support for the child whatsoever. That would be, you know, the responsibility of her family. Now, some people think that this means that the women just kind of sleep around with whoever they want at any time. That's not quite how it works. A woman is rarely seeing multiple men at any time. And if she doesn't know who the father of a child is, it is kind of seen as a little, I don't know the right term, I guess classless, I guess, is probably the closest thing I could come up with it. It's kind of considered a maybe not the best thing, because while there's no stigma attached to the child in those situations, part of their cultural dynamic is when a child, you know, turns one, the father's female family members will visit and present gifts to the child and the mother. That's, you know, just kind of a polite neighborly thing to do in that community. And men can also give personal gifts to help support the child. And again, he's not required to do this, but it does give him a certain amount of prestige in the community, lets people know that he's not, you know, that he's not just in it for, you know, himself. You know, he does care about the wider Moswo family and clans or whatever you want to call it. It allows him to earn, you know, honor in, again, their wider communities. Not knowing who the father is kind of prevents this. So, you know, again, women can have multiple partners, but they, you know, they're not necessarily something they're doing all the time. And it is something, generally, like, it is a marriage, it's just not a marriage. These people are, in most cases, loyal to one another. It's just that if they ever fall out of love or affection with each other, it's not a big deal. It doesn't cause rifts necessarily in a family. Also some Moswo women and men choose to enter more traditional marriages with people outside of their communities. And that's something that is becoming more and more common as you reach the modern day. They also allow for adoptions. This is especially common if families are missing children of a certain gender for a specific generation. Say, like, you don't have any women, your entire domicile is run by women. Like, you need someone to eventually take over. So in some situations like that, they'll invite, they'll maybe adopt a child from a family that has too many girls, or maybe a family that is just too small to kind of continue on their own. They're having trouble keeping up their property and stuff like that. And in those cases, adopted girls can eventually become the matriarchs of the families they were adopted into. So, but yes, that is an example of a matrifocal society in East Asia. There are others in East Asia, though I think they're mostly in kind of maritime Southeast Asia, though that's not the only ones. There are a couple of others, and we'll talk about more of those later. But I do want to get back to the main focus for this episode. And if you listened last week, you will know we didn't get too far down that time frame, and that was because there were a couple of other sites that I didn't mention that were contemporaneous with the cultures further upriver from what we discussed last week. Now, again, as always, this is not an overview of hunting and gathering or pastoralist groups. These groups, of course, existed, but they did not, but they're not as present in the archaeological record or undergoing as a rapid of change. Now, we're again going to run into the issue of how unique are these cultures from each other? How are they related? Are they related at all? How much influence did they have on each other? Who influenced who more? These are all debated, and answers aren't exactly quick in coming. So I'll go over what we do know, and then we'll kind of see where we are. To start, there are 2 to 3 Neolithic cultures emerging between 6 and 5,800 BC. These are the Lao Guan Tai, Dadiwan, and Bajia cultures. Now, Lao Guan Tai translates as something like the old official tower. The name comes from an old ruined village, in Xihua County, which was over the Neolithic site. I think they were doing some cleanup, and then as they were digging, they discovered, evidence of the Neolithic site. Now, there were some other villages found nearby, and none were that large or complex, but they generally had, you know, kind of the same amount of tools, lifestyle, that kind of thing. I couldn't get a firm idea of their estimated population, unfortunately. Now, like many other Neolithic cultures, they relied not only on agriculture, but also hunting and gathering. However, the Lao Guan Tai appears to have been more reliant on agriculture than, say, the Pelagon culture. And they, at least at the earlier phases, they were more reliant on agriculture earlier than, say, the Pelagon were. Now, their pottery wasn't as sophisticated as, you know, the neighboring cultures to the east that we talked about last time. The clay they used was sandier and not as thick, and they didn't have quite as wide a variety of different shapes and sizes, though they did have some variety, more than you know, a lot of early Neolithic cultures say when they're first starting out do, which is part of the reason that they think they may be an offshoot of someone, or at least some people think they may be an offshoot of another culture. But one thing they are doing early that the earlier than, say, the Pelagong were, is that they were painting their pottery and decorating it a little bit more elaborately a little bit earlier. They also had round houses and storage buildings and pits. They also had kind of a rectangular communal burial plots. And the dead were given grave goods of pottery, as well as, you know, tools that, conceivably that the people used while they were alive. And as well, you know, they had ornamentation, things like that. It seems like most of their tools were made of stone. No bone tools were mentioned in the sources I found. And sadly, I couldn't really find too much about this culture in English. There are a few sources, but they're very sparse in what I could find. Specifically, there's a website, Yellow River Civilization. That's the only place I could find a lot of information from, all in one place. I did see that the closest river to them was the Yonghe, but the village itself wasn't built on the river. It was a couple of kilometers away. Now, this site will continue with these types of tools and lifestyle for about 1,000 years, more or less unchanged. Again, the pottery does start to get a little bit better. Even though they're already painting it, they become a little bit more expressive in their artistic sense. But by and large, it's very, very much the same for around 1,000 years. And all of the Lao Guantai sites, it's very similar for around 1,000 years. And then around 5,000 or BC, the artifacts change, though we'll talk about that change shortly, or at least if not this week, then next week when we talk about the Yongshao cult. Apologies for the quick cut there. There was a very loud car alarm going off, so I think I got most of it, but I also think I cut off my last sentence about culture. So apologies for that. Now, this leads us into our next culture we'll be discussing for this week, and that is Da Diwan. Now, if you take the characters individually, it's like Big Land Bay, but Da Di, the two characters together, Big Land is just meant to mean Earth, so it's probably something like Earthen Bay, something along those lines. Now, this culture emerges around 5,800, give or take 50 to 100 years one way or the other. And there are some who believe that this is an offshoot of the Lao Guantai. Part of that is due to how similar their pottery is, at least initially. Though this is much further west than the Lao Guantai. This is closer to the mountains. It's further upriver. It's near... it's closer to the mountains along the Jing and Wei rivers. Wei He River. I think there's two different Wei rivers, but just kind of keep that in mind. Now, while initially they're pretty similar in terms of artifacts, if they are related, the Da Di Wan do begin to kind of innovate, I guess, or develop an independent identity. The Da Di Wan do use stone tools, much like the Lao Guantai. However, specific mention is made of bone tools for this group. And all of their bone tools are very well polished. Their stone tools are a mix of polished and just chipped, like, you know, classic chipping and breaking off larger segments to reveal like a core, and then that core is then sharpened. But they use both. I imagine that in some situations, you know, some tools may be easier to just chip away and use naturally, whereas some, it probably helps them retain use to be a little bit better polished. Though I'm not 100% sure. That's just kind of my understanding and my kind of guesswork from reading stuff. Now, the Dai Diwan is not the only site associated with the Dai Diwan culture. There are a few more. There is Beiliu, Weinan, and these are across both the Shanxi and the Gansu provinces. And most Chinese archaeologists think that there are probably more Dai Diwan sites that they just haven't found, maybe a little bit in one direction or the other. But those are the ones that are currently been discovered. Now, like the Lao Guan Tai, this was initially discovered in the 1970s. They did more field work there pretty much straight through to the mid-80s. And then they returned back in like two or three times during the 2000s. I think the most recent trip I saw mentioned was in 2009, was the last time they had done a survey. So they keep investigating this site to see if they can find more artifacts. And generally, I think they have been successful. I think they have a good idea of what may still be in certain areas. They just have to kind of go back and look. Now, in terms of pottery, again, very similar to the Lao Guan Tai. However, they do implement, in addition to painting, they also have some pottery that they used corded ware. They would, tie cords around it to create patterns, and also probably to kind of give a place for you to tie rope for use later. Unfortunately, I couldn't find very many pictures of their pottery that was used as with corded ware, but I did find some pictures of some of their painted pottery. Unfortunately, not very much of it is in color, but I will be including pictures of that on the version that goes up on YouTube. Now, they would also, some of their potteries actually had human faces on the front of them. So I'm not sure, you know, if that was, if there's a specific, period that that's from. That may be from the later Yangshao culture, because I know that the Yangshao had that too. But I'm going to include it. But Dai Diwan itself will be occupied by the incoming Yangshao culture after it's abandoned. Basically, the Yangshao will eventually kind of reoccupy the site. And at that point, agriculture becomes even more important to the area. Now, in addition to agriculture, as I mentioned, they hunted and gathered. There's a lot of deer bones. But they also kept domesticated animals. Pig jaws have been found, and it appears that these are domesticated pigs, though again, early domesticated animals are sometimes hard to differentiate between wild animals and domesticated strains. But I will again include that pottery so you can see it. I did not mention, but the Lao Guan Tai, they did have dogs. I didn't see any other domesticated animals mentioned, but it wouldn't surprise me, again, if they had pigs as well. Though, again, it's not specifically mentioned, so maybe they didn't. You would think if the Dai Diwan is an offshoot, did they get pigs from the Lao Guan Tai, or did they adopt them on their own, or get them from another group and then spread them back to the Lao Guan Tai? That's just one of those questions that is, again, heavily debated. Their homes are very similar to the Lao Guan Tai. They're circular. They also had circular burial pits and, not burial pits, storage pits, as well as, storage buildings. Now, at Dai Diwan itself, there was a very large earthen mound that has been discovered. It was around 3,000 and 4,500 square feet, which is between 290 and 420 square meters. And it has like a outer kind of courtyard. And the Chinese archaeologists believe it was a communal meeting hall. This was not found at other Dadiwan sites, so perhaps this is somewhere that neighboring Dadiwan peoples came, had meetings. So possibly, you know, kind of like a kind of clan or extended family kind of gathering place. And it was built on, they basically rammed earth up to make the foundation, and then they layered that foundation with burnt clay. So just take that into account as well. Which, again, that's not something that you see at the Lao Guan Tai sites, at least it's been found so far. Now, as for the length of occupation, it appears like the Dadiwan lasts from about 5,800 to about 5,400 BC, BCE. So it is not as long-lasting as, say, the Lao Guan Tai or some of the other Neolithic sites. Well, I guess the ones to the east are about as long. So, you know, about 400 years is a pretty decent run for a lot of these cultures. The Lao Guan Tai lasting as long as they did is, you know, is impressive when you take into account, considering they don't seem to be at least quite as advanced, at least in terms when it comes to number of sites and kind of their tool variety. But that could just be me projecting. I don't know. just kind of what I get from the sources. Now, this leads us into the last culture we'll be talking about for this week, and that's the Bajia culture. This culture is, again, very similar in terms of pottery, very simplistic, but it is generally painted red or different shades of red, as the case may be. The name comes from, it's like the 100 homes or the 100 surnames. Home can be, or at least the character Jia can mean one or the other, I think. It depends on the context. But that kind of tells you maybe what the kind of the makeup of the site was like. There is a number of homes there they think have supported around 100 people or so. Now, I believe the Bajia is a little bit closer to where the Lao Guan Tai would have been, though it is still within the same province of, or the artifacts have been found in the same province as the Dadiwan. I think there's a break between where the Lao Guan Tai and the Bajia are. At least in obviously modern terminology. In the past, that's obviously not the case. The Bajia are not in the mountains or the foothills like the Dadiwan would have been. They're a little bit closer to they're kind of in where the Yellow River kind of begins to funnel through like the large central plains of China. They are near, or they are on, I should say, they were right on the Yehe River, which is one of the, I guess, right where that river begins to curve to the north to begin to meet the Yellow River proper. The Bajia is about, I think it's around 750 kilometers to the east of the Dadiwan and about 200 kilometers to the west of where, of the county, Jiwa County, where the Lao Guan Tai were located. So they're on different rivers, but they're far closer to each other than they were to the Dadiwan. Now, unfortunately, as there were few sources with the Lao Guan Tai, there are even less in English for the Bajia. And a lot of like English stuff, the Bajia are considered an offshoot of the Dadiwan. Why they don't kind of combine them together more, at least in the literature, I don't know. Maybe that's a recency thing. Maybe just recently they're kind of leading to think, more people are perhaps leading to think that the Bajia are an offshoot of the Dadiwan, whereas before that may have been a little bit more debated. But regardless, they're emerging around the same time. So I don't necessarily think that they're a direct offshoot, but I do think there is a certain level of kind of cultural continuation between these three clusters. Though, again, how closely they're associated, that is a matter of, you know, debate. I think probably day to day, they're very independent of each other, but, you know, the Dadiwan being so close to the mountains, they have access to a lot more stone than you'll see in, say, Bajia or Jiwa. The Lao Guan Tai culture. Excuse me, I supplemented or swapped the names there between the county and the culture. So, unfortunately, there's not really too many pictures to go with the Bajia. So I'll basically put where they're located on a map. This culture lasts about the same time period as the Dadiwan. They are, again, reliant on agriculture, hunt and gather, fish too, because they are right on that river. Their site is right next to it, whereas the Dadiwan is a little bit further away, as is the Lao Guan Tai. So I'm not quite sure what to make of that. Maybe they needed to be closer to the river. Maybe the land was better to be closer to the river. Of course, you know, rivers in China do fluctuate, as all rivers do, though if there are ever any natural disasters, they might fluctuate more. And with how seismically active Western China can be, you know, there's a very good chance that these rivers have shifted quite a bit from their current flows. But yeah, I wish I had more to give you on the Bajia. They're just kind of attached as a footnote on the Dadiwan, though again, they emerged around the same time. I'm not sure why they are, you know, so connected. But I'll defer to the archaeologists on that one. It might just be because their artifacts are so similar. In fact, I'm 99% sure that is why they're kind of grouped together. Because there's not much else to go on, obviously. There's no differences in burial practices that are mentioned. Their lifestyles are very similar. So there's kind of a very broad continuum between these upper Yellow River and lower Yellow River cultures between each other. And there's not too much of evidence connecting those two separate areas just yet. However, that is going to change, as we will discuss next week when we begin to dive into the Yang Shao culture. Now, this culture is going to be very, very widespread. It's going to kind of overtake the material cultures of all these sites. Now, some of these sites are abandoned for a brief period of time before Yang Shao peoples, or the people associated with the Yang Shao material culture, arrives. There's about a 400-year gap where Dadiwan is and where Bajia is. Those end about 400 years before the Yang Shao really begin to be established and then spread out. Though there are already some evidence that maybe the Yang Shao is a little bit older than what we might expect. Though the Yang Shao itself is broken into different phases. And we'll be going over basically the first phase, the early Yang Shao period. And this one is going to really take over most of the Weihe River. And then, as we'll see in later seasons, they're going to begin to move out and to occupy these places that have been abandoned. So that's going to be our big focus for next week, is the Yang Shao. And after that, there are a couple of other Neolithic cultures in China, kind of on, kind of towards the coast and the very far north east, kind of moving into Korea. And then after that, I have to figure out where we're going next. We still need to do maritime Southeast Asia. We still need to do Australia. And then we'll probably swing back up to North Asia. I'm just not sure exactly where we're going to go next. I think we're probably going to focus on kind of developments in Korea and Japan after the remaining cultures in China. But that's for me to figure out and just for you guys to listen and enjoy. But I do want to thank everyone for joining me this week. Sorry I had a little bit of, off-topic stuff. Not really off-topic, but kind of just more critique of the, critique of the disciplines of history and archaeology and that kind of stuff. It's not something I generally like to get into, especially when it gets into politics stuff. Sometimes politics can affect academics in undue ways. And again, there's no saying that these earlier interpretations are wrong. It's just that there's not really any physical, actual evidence of it. But that's all stuff we'll get into later. It's important to remember that, for this far back, things like matriarchy, patriarchy are probably not any hard and fast rule. I imagine that, different societies have bounced back and forth between different levels of patriarchy and matriarchy. It's really only once you get into fully stratified or not necessarily stratified, but stratified is part of it. It's not really until these cultures kind of get more cemented that they become one or the other. There's always exceptions to rules. I kind of don't like painting with so broad a brush, but it is what it is. Sometimes that's what you have to do to kind of teach and learn about a subject. And there's always, again, room for interpretations or leeway you can find on edge cases that shows that maybe it wasn't quite as black and white as we like to think of it. So just some food for thought, and just me rambling, getting a little philosophical here, but So if you guys have any questions, comments, constructive criticism, please let me know, and I will try to answer as best I can. I hope you will enjoy this episode, and if you do, again, have any of that kind of feedback, please reach out to me via email at waradrevpod@gmail.com. You can direct message me on X/Twitter, which I still haven't updated recently. I need to do that. Of course, you can comment on the YouTube videos. I do see comments there. It may take me a little bit to respond there, but I do try to respond fairly promptly where I can. And if you do subscribe to me on YouTube, I stream during the week there live most nights, sometimes on the weekends like this past weekend. And just drop by and say hey if you'd like. I think we're at 280, 281, something like that on YouTube right now. So I appreciate the support. Just seeing the channel grow. I think we've picked up around 40 subscribers the last couple of weeks. So I'm really happy with that. But thank you all for joining me. I'll see everyone next time. Hope you have a good rest of your day and week from whenever you're listening to this. Till next time, peace.